Hello and welcome to the New Books in Public Policy podcast, a part of the New Books Network. I'm Nick Sagos. The New Books Network is a series of podcasts dedicated to raising the level of public discourse by introducing serious authors to serious audiences. My guest today is Tom Sorrell, who is professor of politics and philosophy and the head of the Interdisciplinary Ethics Research Group in Politics and International Studies at the University of Warwick. He is also an RCUK Global Uncertainties Leadership Fellow. Previously, he was John Ferguson Professor of Global Ethics and the director of the Center for the Study of Global Ethics at the University of Birmingham. He was coordinator of the FP7 Detector Project and is leader of two work packages in the FP7 Survey Project. He has published extensively in moral and political philosophy, including four books and many journal articles. His current research deals with the moral and political issues raised by emergencies, including terrorist emergencies. I'm happy to speak with him today. The book we are discussing is Emergencies in Politics, A Sober Hobbesian Approach. It is newly published by Cambridge University Press. Tom Sorrell argues that emergencies can justify types of action that would normally be regarded as wrong. Beginning with the ethics of emergencies facing individuals, he explores the range of effective and legitimate private emergency response and its relation to public institutions, such as national governments. He develops a theory of the response of governments to public emergencies, which indicates the possibility of a democratic politics that is liberal but that takes seriously threats to life and limb from public disorder, crime, or terrorism. Informed by Hobbes, Schmitt, and Walzer, but substantially different from them, the book widens the justification for recourse to normally forbidden measures without resorting to illiberal politics. This book will interest students of politics, public policy, philosophy, international relations, and law. Hello, Professor Sorrell.
Hello, hi.
Can you begin by saying a few words about yourself? Where were you born? That kind of thing.
Sure. I was actually born in Mexico City, and I lived there for 4 years. I then moved to Vancouver and grew up in Canada, ending up in Montreal. I did my undergraduate work at McGill, and I did all my graduate work at Oxford. And I've lived in England ever since I finished my DPhil from 1979, so I've been here a long, long time.
Right. And throughout your academic trajectory, did you have a specific mentor or a specific group of scholars that you worked closely with?
Well, my career has changed a bit since I started. My DPhil was in epistemology. Before that, I worked on Wittgenstein. I didn't work on moral and political philosophy at all as a graduate student, and more or less trained myself in it. I did work with tremendous people in Oxford. I was supervised by P.F. Strawson, by Simon Blackburn, by John McDowell, by Gareth Evans, a lot of different people, and all of these people have influenced me. My last DPhil supervisor was David Pears. So I've worked with a lot of different people.
That's fantastic. So I guess we should just jump right into it. How did you come to write Emergencies in Politics?
Well, it grows fairly naturally out of several things that I've done in the past. As I say in the book, it was one of the immediate inspirations for the issues discussed there was a book I published in 2000 or so called Moral Theory and Anomaly. And in that book, I was interested in cases where systematic moral theories seem not to apply to certain problems. And one of the areas that seemed to raise problems for systematic moral theory was emergency, because in the case of emergency, the usual set of prohibitions and prescriptions tended to have exceptions. So emergency seemed to be a general area of difficulty for conventional morality and for theories that systematize conventional morality. So that was one source of my interest in this subject. And then I've been working on Hobbes for a long, long time. I published a book on Hobbes in 1986, and I've been publishing on Hobbes ever since. I've published many, many articles on Hobbes. And so both of those books were sources for the work that I've done here. And I've also done some work on the historiography of philosophy. And that also has an influence. The way I use Hobbes, the original Hobbes, and then revise that original Hobbes, I have views about how you write the history of philosophy that make that legitimate.
Did the events of 9/11 have anything to do with adding an impetus to the project, or were you already on the way to writing that kind of thing?
No, I have to admit, 9/11 and the literature that was inspired by 9/11 has structured quite a lot of the debate about the way that liberalism responds to emergency. So I think 9/11 was an important inspiration. But I have to say, if I'm talking autobiographically, that mm-hmm. that I was so to speak directly affected by the War Measures Act in Canada in 1971 to 72 when that act was declared in Canada. You may not have been alive then, but I was at that point a student journalist on the McGill Daily. And I remember that when the War Measures Act was declared, there was police at the Ontario-Quebec border, and it was difficult to cross. And I had newspapers next to me that were saying that support was mounting for the FLQ, and the police took a very dim view of those newspapers. When I got to Ottawa, I was going to a newspaper conference. That was the day that Pierre Laporte's body was found in the trunk of a car. And mm-hmm. and I went to Parliament Hill that day and saw many, many famous politicians, including Pierre Trudeau, in quite a lot of disarray. So I experienced emergency, so to speak, at first hand, or the reaction to emergency at first hand, though in a very liberal jurisdiction.
Right. Interesting. I hadn't seen the parallel in the book, but now that you mention it makes sense. All right. Well, I guess my next question would be, for someone who hasn't read the book, what do you mean by emergency specifically? You know, how do you draw a distinction between a private emergency, a public emergency? Aren't all emergencies in some sense equal or isomorphic?
Well, both private and public emergencies have something in common. I guess what all emergencies have in common is that there is an imminent threat of either loss of life or serious injury, and something has to be done quickly in order to avert or minimize it. That's the sort of generic idea of emergency. But the difference between private and public emergency, as I understand it, is to do with whether the people confronting the emergency, or whether the people responsible for the emergency, are an individual or an institution. If it's an institution, and then we talk about different kinds of political institutions, and the emergency involves threats of injury or loss of life to large numbers of people, then it becomes a public emergency. And if it's another sort of emergency that faces just an individual, then it's a private emergency.
Right. Okay. So what types of actions do emergencies authorize on your view that would traditionally be off limits in liberal societies?
Well, I think that when one's talking about permissions that are given to people in emergencies in liberal societies, one's mainly talking about the way that governments are given permissions. And I can come to that, but the way that the book is structured, what one's really talking about is what permissions are given to all agents in emergencies, given the importance of life-saving and minimizing serious injury in morality in general. So the general line that's taken is that in emergencies, the overridingness of saving life and preventing, if one can prevent it, serious emergency, the overridingness of those things suddenly becomes extremely salient, whereas in normal life, where normal life is taken to be lived outside a danger zone and outside of immediate threats to life, that's the way it works in the developed world, the overridingness of saving life and of preventing injury tends not to be salient. It tends to be latent in people's experience. So what emergency does is to make salient, to press up to the surface, the overridingness of saving life and of preventing serious injury. And what that overridingness implies is that when saving life conflicts with observing other prescriptions or observing other prohibitions, the necessity of saving life or of preventing serious injury wins. And it's in that sense that what's normally regarded as wrongdoing becomes permissible, so long as it's done as a means to saving life or preventing a serious injury.
Right. So I guess the next question is there a threshold on your view that separates legitimate from illegitimate institutional responses to emergency events? Is it, for example, a matter of establishing a harm threshold, or is harm the wrong metaphor through which to understand your view?
No, harm, I think, is certainly going to be the broad category of thing that one takes into account. But I think that there are two. Again, there's a theory of emergency that is concerned with political agents or institutional agents, and that's quite involved in the book. And then there's another theory about the propriety of individual emergency response. And I think that what's going on in what connects up these two areas is that I say that in order for for private emergency response, the response to emergencies by individuals to be tractable, there starts to be a need for institutions that divide the labor of responding to institutions. So I want to say that in many different cases, individual responses to emergency can involve people in playing God, in, for example, rationing life-saving goods, and that in order for decisions that are made of that kind not to be arbitrary and for them not to proceed from individuals playing God, one needs to have emergency institutions. So the ethics of individual emergency response lead, so to speak, to the discovery of the need for institutions which cater for emergency. And then as soon as one's got institutions that cater for emergency, the question arises which institutions those are and how they should be controlled. And that's where one gets into the question of how liberalism and institutional emergency response connect up.
Okay, all right. That clarifies matters. You mix Hobbesian and Razian influences in your account. Can you outline what you take from Hobbes and what you take from Raz? Is it simply that Hobbes takes the threat of emergencies more seriously than other liberals, or do you find something particularly attractive in Raz's view of practical reason, which you think connects well with Hobbesian concerns?
Well, my inclination is just to say yes, yes to various of the things that you've suggested there. The way these two things go together is fairly complicated. The reason that Hobbes comes in is to do with the idea in the book of a black hole, and a black hole is going to be a set of circumstances in which everything seems to be permitted to agents. So, you know, I give the example in the first chapter of our being confronted, say, on Earth with the idea of with the prospect of colliding with a giant piece of space debris, which then devastates the Earth. And I guess that if people were confronted with that kind of thing, they might say, "Oh well, we'll all be dead tomorrow, so all bets are off," and I'll gratify myself in any way that I like. Whether that would actually take place or not, we can set aside. But the question of the black hole is something that's important in my account of why emergencies might be thought to be necessary to avoid. It's not just the harm; it might also be that emergencies are particularly likely locations for the occurrence of a black hole. And the more widespread the emergency, the more unavoidable the emergency, the more overwhelming the emergency, as in the case of the Earth being struck by the space debris, the more people might be thinking that everything might be permitted. So that's the idea of the black hole. And of course, there's a connection between this idea of a black hole and Hobbes, because Hobbes thought that the state of nature was a black hole, that without government, human beings would basically behave as if there was a black hole, that everything is permitted. So the way that the argument runs at the beginning of the book is, I say, why do emergencies need to be avoided? One answer is harm. The other is perhaps the possibility of a black hole. I tend to be skeptical of the suggestion that a black hole might be present wherever an emergency facing an individual is. But I think it's more plausible to say that there's a bigger probability of a black hole the more widespread and overwhelming the emergency. And that's what's my excuse for confronting the general Hobbesian position that the state of nature is a black hole. And what I basically say is that a claim of Hobbes is exaggerated, and that one doesn't need to make Hobbes's assumptions that the state of nature is a black hole in order to reach his conclusion that security is an important responsibility of government. So there's a very involved argument as to why what Hobbes claims is an exaggeration. But you know, to cut to the positive position and the way that Hobbes and Raz are finally used to come up with a positive account, basically what I say is the following: that Hobbes was right to say that security is a very fundamental reason for our organizing ourselves into states. And I also say that though Hobbes is wrong about human nature putting us at odds with one another so that if the state doesn't exist, we're all at war, I say that he's correct to say that a war is on the cards and that special difficulties are on the cards when people have fundamentalist attachments. So fundamentalist attachments are attachments to goods that people have when they are willing to die if they don't have them, or willing to die in the fight to keep them. Those fundamentalist attachments, which Hobbes thinks many human beings naturally have, I deny that most human beings have, but I say those human beings, those may be a minority of human beings who do have fundamentalist attachments, they are a particularly important security threat. And so I take from Hobbes both the importance of taking measures against fundamentalists, and I also take it to be important for other reasons, as well as the threat of fundamentalists, that security is a fundamental responsibility of the state. Now, the reason that I resort to Raz is because I can't, from Hobbesian materials alone, come up with a plausible answer to the question of why we should form ourselves into a state. It's not plausible that security should be the entirely organizing a value that we're able to realize by forming ourselves into a state, contrary to Hobbes. It's much more plausible that security constrains the fundamental value rather than being the fundamental value. And it's a more likely fundamental value than security is the value of being able to lead one's life autonomously. So what I'm saying is basically, just to summarize this part of the book, is that Hobbes had this interesting idea about a black hole connected with the state of nature. His reasons for thinking that rest on exaggeration, but there's a kernel of truth in those things. When we take seriously the kernel of truth and try to solve it with Hobbes's resources, we still don't get the kind of theory he claimed to be giving, which was a rationale for the state and a rationale that also located the value of security. And it's because of the limitations of even a neo-Hobbesian approach to that question that I resort to Raz. And basically what I take from Raz is this, that institutions are devices for bringing about states of affairs that individuals have reasons to pursue anyway, individually, but that institutions coordinate activity and make it the case that these effects can be brought about more efficiently than if individuals did things on their own. I also say, as against Hobbes, that he himself, Hobbes himself, is committed to the idea that individuals are capable of a reasonable degree of detachment, even though he often also says that they are incapable of a fair degree of detachment. So in order to clean up this mess, I simply show that he's committed to individuals having a great degree of attachment and being able to detach themselves from some of their passions. And in order to come up with a theory that recognizes that fact, I need a theory that has a fairly robust understanding of practical reason. That's what I get from Raz. I also get from Raz an organizing value of the state that's a bit more coherently an organizing value than security. But I also get from Raz a theory that gives a great deal of weight to security, much more weight than is generally recognized by students of Raz. By putting together Raz's emphasis on autonomy and Raz's emphasis on practical reason and reason as reasons for institutions, I'm able to liberalize Hobbes, but in a way that's not very, very liberalizing. It's a very modestly liberalized Hobbes. And I have to subtract from Raz quite a lot of material that doesn't serve this purpose, and that is itself, as I try to show in the book, independently problematic. I hope that's an answer.
Oh yes, that's excellent. It's very interesting how you manage to maintain the core insight from Hobbes and yet also keep him sort of liberal in a way that modern or contemporary liberals don't find objectionable. I wanted next to discuss something that you treat in Chapter 7, your dissatisfaction with thicker notions of security rather than the thinner notion that you advocate. Is it simply that thicker notions of security don't get the balance between threats that come from outside the state and threats that come from within the state itself? Or is there more to your dissatisfaction with the thicker notion of security?
Well, yes. I think there is a bit more to it than that. Essentially, what I'm trying to argue that a notion of security that's connected with physical injury and threat to life is not just the core concept of security, but really the much of the concept of security. And the approaches that I'm trying to criticize are approaches that seem to me to confuse the concept of well-being with security, or that run together insecurity with disadvantage. So if one looks at approaches, and these are not always academic approaches, but they do have a number of exponents in academia, if one looks at the so-called the concept of human security, this is a concept that's been promoted by Amartya Sen, among other people, and also by human rights practitioners. There the idea is that unless one has, so to speak, most of the human rights, the civil and political human rights, and some of the economic and social human rights satisfied within a given jurisdiction, people are insecure, and that the threshold for being secure includes being educated, being literate, having health care, and the whole range of goods that are secured by human rights. And my view is that that is a fairly obvious inflation of the concept of security into the concept of having rights fulfilled. Mm-hmm. And I think that you know, that's I simply try to show that by showing some of the implausibilities of that line of thought. For example, it's certainly not a condition of security that one be literate. One could have very peaceful peasant illiterate societies in which people don't fear for their lives and aren't even threatened with illness necessarily. That's entirely conceivable. But it's not conceivable that you could be secure with threats to life or important threats of injury. And I think that's the area of conceptual unpacking that that I carry out there when I'm critical of thick notions of security.
Given that, are you led to a statist version of Hobbesianism that is antithetical to cosmopolitanism, or is it just that you think any viable cosmopolitan alternative has to have a strong statist component?
Well,
I realize I'm jumping around a little bit, but I want to get to the key, the key themes of the book.
Sure. I think on the question of cosmopolitanism, there is a way of running cosmopolitanism within a Hobbesian framework. That's to say, threats to life and serious injury, those kinds of things could generate interests and rights within the, you know, the sober Hobbesian framework that everyone had to recognize. So people being threatened with death in the Philippines, for example, that generates some sort of claim on other people. Their insecurity is objectively a bad thing, and everyone, regardless of their national affiliations, has a reason for doing something about it. So to that extent, the Hobbesian apparatus and cosmopolitanism march in step. But where cosmopolitanism and Hobbes part company, I think, is that to the extent that states have obligations, governments have obligations to intervene in humanitarian ways or to provide aid, it can't be at the cost of insecurity of members of that state. So, in other words, there can be situations that are consistent with sober Hobbesianism, where aid needs to be given on broadly cosmopolitan grounds, viz., because humans are injured or humans are threatened with loss of life, and those situations can be consistent with sober Hobbesianism, where to respond to those situations creates no security threat to a given state. But where it does, all bets are off. And if there are systematic reasons for thinking that cosmopolitanism in practice would always generate insecurity, then there would be systematic reasons for opposing cosmopolitanism.
Right. Okay. Well, that's an excellent overview of the book. By way of conclusion, I'd like to know what you're working on next after what must have been a very difficult and, you know, exhaustive process of writing this book. What are your new projects? What are you working on now?
Well, because I work with my group on a lot of funded research, I'm really working on a whole range of projects which have their own, so to speak, publication agendas with them. And I'm probably not looking at a book project in the very near future. I'm really just looking at smaller outputs on a whole range of questions. I'm still working in the broad area of counterterrorism and serious and organized crime, those kinds of things, which I think are connected with the themes of the book. But I'm also working on a project connected with a financial crisis, a very different kind of emergency, if it is an emergency. And I'm working on other issues like privacy and surveillance, which also come out of the work that I've been doing on terrorism.
Right. All right. Well, that's great. Thank you very much for your time. The book, once again, is Emergencies in Politics, A Sober Hobbesian Approach. The author is Tom Sorrell. and it is published by Cambridge University Press. Thank you very much, Professor Sorrell.
Thank you.